hello, hello.
Here we are again.
I'm so glad to be back here on Dubway Studios in New York, New York. New York, New York, the Big Apple.
The Big Apple. Let's take a bite out of the Big Apple today.
Take Manhattan, the Bronx, and you can leave Staten.
A quintessential New York City chef. Mark Forgione will be here with us. I am beyond excited to talk to this man because whenever he walks into any room, a calm comes across.
I've never spent time with Mark Forgione, and I'm very excited to get a little touch of his wisdom and see that hairdo.
Can't wait to talk to Mark.
I'm very excited. I'm very excited because you're a New York guy.
I am. Born and raised. Not a lot of them.
And I'm a New York guy. I grew up in the city. I was born in New Jersey. It's a dirty Jersey, a little secret.
Oh, where Boonton, were you born?
Boonton, New Jersey. No Never way. Went back. That was it. I left the hospital. But my brother still is like, you're not a New Yorker. You know? Okay, sorry. Okay, well,
you are a New Yorker.
Being a New Yorker is like being like a chef.
Right? Yeah,
like,
but
once
like,
you're a chef, you're a chef.
Like, yeah. That's true. You went to NYU, you know, you lived here for like three
weeks.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, you got to.
I'm from New York. I'm like, are you? All right, what do you got?
I don't know. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. This is the On the Line podcast. We're so happy to have you. It always makes me smile to see you.
Yeah, for sure.
Really, I love your energy so much.
Oh, yeah.
And Dan's going to read your illustrious bio that he himself has written.
All right.
I spent a good bit of time researching.
There's nothing like sitting in a seat and having somebody read to you about yourself.
Mm-hmm. The idea is to butter you up.
Not awkward at all.
Next up on the line, we are thrilled to welcome a man whose mohawk needs no introduction. Mark Forgione is a household name these days, but his journey to the top was long and arduous, and his Iron Chef title, well earned. I was going to do like a Forged in Fire reference with your, like the TV show and your name, but I couldn't come up with it. I'm working on it. But I got it, you know, good drum roll. Mark started his professional career at the tender age of 16 years old in one of New York's most respected culinary establishments. He has a formal degree from the University of Massachusetts School of Restaurant Management and spent years honing his craft in some of the world's most respected restaurants, including time in Michel Girard's iconic Michelin-starred kitchens, which is, for those of you that don't know, something really special restaurant. As a chef, he's helped redefine the culinary landscape, ushering in a new era of high-end chain restaurants. That's a real thing. Like before you, anyway, we'll talk about that. Mark was the guy who told us fancy food can be fun. And as an owner, Mark returned to his roots, operating a legion of beloved restaurants, mentoring the next generation of culinary talent and maintaining institutions that otherwise would have fallen. Loved by many, respected by all, I am humbled and honored to meet and learn from a man who epitomizes American culinary royalty.
Woo!
Mark,
right. That's good.
Yes.
Forgione, ladies and gentlemen. Jesus,
God,
you're gonna have to email that one to me. Mark, good. That's good.
That's extremely. That's your new bio, by the way.
That's it.
When somebody needs a bio, for
I am not making this up. I had a meeting yesterday about my bio.
Really?
I swear to you. Jesus. That's it. Done.
See,
I love it.
You ask and the universe gives.
I want to clarify the chain restaurant thing.
I'm confused
really,
by that myself.
I know because.
I mean, I'd love to have a chain restaurant if you know anybody
it's not,
looking.
I feel like you worked in restaurants that as a chef, not before as a chef owner, but before you were really like your own restaurant's identity, but that had multiple iterations of the same thing
at
a time. Yeah, at a time when that was really not a thing. It was like either it was one great restaurant or chain restaurants that had multiple iterations were kind of not great restaurants. And for the first time, it was like, hey, it's okay to love a restaurant and want it to have it in multiple cities and it to be fancy and it for it to be expensive, but it also can be fun. Like it was an evolution in the culinary process that I think is a real step.
Yeah, so. Honestly, and that time that I spent with BLT was like beyond formative. It was like going to opening restaurant school.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
I bet, because I mean, when I came up, that was not really heard of. And every restaurant had its own identity and its own issues, and you were never replicating it. No. As a matter of fact, you didn't want anybody to replicate that. Mm-hmm. You would protect it.
If you want to see us, you got to come here.
Right. Kind of exactly. So that's actually a really interesting point. Yeah.
And for me, you know, I think, chain restaurant had like a negative. So, as a person who opened multiple iterations of the same restaurant, it helped me to feel kind of like okay about that.
Yeah. You know, ironically, the last space that I helped them like set up was the one in LA.
Oh, really?
It was the old La Dome.
Yeah.
La Duomo, Dome?
La Duomo.
Duomo.
It's on Sunset Boulevard.
Let's make everything Italian today.
What, could you have a different accent? Do you have like a different accent depending upon? I find myself doing like
my wife gets so mad at me.
You do.
Really?
She gets so mad at me.
My wife gets very angry at me. She's like that pizza guy accent that you do. Yeah. It's so obnoxious. I'm like, I don't know what to say.
On where you are.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I have excuses though. Okay. I have excuses. So, I actually lived in France. So, and you know, for a time I only spoke French. So when I'm around French people, forget it.
Of course.
It's like, oh, la la, David, c'est quoi, mon Dieu. And like, my wife's like, you don't speak French anymore. I'm like, well, you know. And then when I'm, you know, technically, you know, my family's from Italy and, you know, my grandfather's 100% Italian. So, you know, when I'm traveling in Italy, I don't. I'm taking lessons, believe it or not. But when, you know, when I'm in Italy, like we were just in Tuscany, you know, and like by the end of the trip, you know, it's like you can't help it.
You do gesticulate violently.
Yeah, well, that that leads to my next thing is I'm like an Italian Long Island kid.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So like when I go back to Long Island,
that's it.
I mean, it's over. It's like, yo, what's up, boys? Where are we going tonight?
Yo,
I haven't seen you guys in like 2 years. Where are we going?
Let's go.
Let's fucking go. Let's go.
It's so true. I hate that you don't love that you're from New Jersey, because I'm from New Jersey. And I am proud. I was born in Jersey City, and I spend a weekend there.
Absolutely.
And I come back, and I'm, let's have some coffee. Let's
talk.
I am
an erudite
Manhattanite. Strong Island.
Strong Island. But you are, we should talk about this, because you are, to me, you are the quintessential New Yorker and the quintessential New York chef. And I have such beloved memories of being in the same neighborhood as you.
Yeah.
We were neighbors. And we were going through sort of the same things in Tribeca.
We came up together.
Yeah. I was a chef at the Harrison. I was lucky to be a part of that Tribeca neighborhood, which I always think of as an elite restaurant area. You know, it was, to me, my first memories of going to Boulay, you know, walking through that door. You know, everything down there was a destination restaurant, Chanterelle, you know, and then you kind of brought in that neighborhood vibe, and the Harrison brought in that neighborhood restaurant vibe. And I just, it's such a unique neighborhood, and I sadly don't just go there. Nobody does. If I have a reservation. So that's why I want to ask you, you have been tried and true. You've stuck with Tribeca mostly. What's going on there and why?
Well, you know, Tribeca, I kind of describe Tribeca as, it's almost like a woman or a man that like you have to like really impress to like get them to take you out on a date, or you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like it's like
you're always courting Tribeca to love you.
You have to, that's a great way to describe it. You have to really court Tribeca, because as you just said, I mean, I'll admit it, like when I went to go look at the space, you know, I got on the 3 train, I got out at Chambers. I was like, what? Where am I?
The only reason you went there
downtown,
was like,
uptown,
you were buying
east.
Fireworks as a kid. You go down below Canal Street. Like, it was a danger zone. It's factories.
Yeah, I mean,
and,
you know. I think at that time in my life, I was 29 years old. But, you know, at that point, living full time in New York for 10 years. I worked downtown in the late 90s in the, like, what's Brookfield now. I'd maybe been to the Patriot a few times when I was working down there. I'd eaten at the Odeon a few times because, again, same thing. I was working down there. But to your point, like, I never, like, went to go to Tribeca. So anyway, so I get out, and, like, I was lost. I had to, like, ask somebody, like, where's Reed Street? And, like, you know.
You went to the knife store, though.
Corinne.
Warren Street.
Yeah.
But again, you would.
You go there and then you get out of Dodge.
Your boss would usually take you in a cab there because you couldn't afford to buy the knife. And then you buy the knife and then you get back in the cab with your boss. Yeah, I don't know. I fell in love with the space. It's hard to explain. Sure.
And it's extraordinary architecture.
It's kind of bittersweet. Like,
yeah,
extraordinary is beautiful.
Yeah.
But like I you know, if you've been to Forge, there's like a two-step deck that you have to walk up. And I remember I was walking up the block and like I saw this like the you know, the French doors were open and there was this outdoor patio and I was just like, please tell me this is the space that I'm going to look at. Because I didn't know yet. I just knew it was on that block. And I, you know, I saw the guy wave and I was like, oh, fuck yeah. And then, but I swear to you, and I know it sounds hokey pokey, but like I took like two steps up the porch and it was like.
No, I love
it. And the place was ugly. Like it was, it had like neon blue, like.
Was it like a bar?
It was called the Deck.
Yes.
But I mean, again, and I'm not making fun of the previous owner, but it was just like, it was, you know, it was like tacky. You know
sure,
what I mean? But I like.
What year was this?
2007 or 8 when I first saw it. But I could like see the bones. Like, you know what I mean? It was just like, holy shit.
It's amazing that you say that because I had an experience through somebody else's eyes. I don't know if you remember Chef Diane Forley.
Yeah.
She was the chef and owner of a restaurant called Verbena. And I.
My favorite Verbena.
I never see it. It smells so beautiful. Yeah, it's elegant.
That was Jean Louis Paladin's daughter's name. I thought it was such a beautiful name, Verbena.
That is nice.
And he would say it with such passion. Anyway,
he did everything with such passion.
Like three packs of Marlboro Reds in. If you touch hell, I will kill you. I was like, all right, buddy.
She took me through the space when it was rubble. It was we had to walk over boards. It was construction. And she said, this is going to be the dining room. This is where the pastry is. This is the garmage. I mean, I'm looking at nothing.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at her and I'm thinking,
You're crazy. Okay?
Yeah. Because I couldn't see it the way she saw it. It was everything she ever wanted. And she saw it. And of course, it came to life. But when you have that moment, it's home.
Yeah.
It's what you dreamed of. So.
And it's crazy, too. I'm telling you, like, if you see, you know, I had my marble notebook, which I still have, you know, it was like, I want to have a 60-seat restaurant. You know what I mean? I want to, you know, I wanted to have, you know, wood and exposed brick and da-da-da-da. You know what I mean? I had all these, like, things. And like, of course, like I pull a curtain aside and like they were covering the brick and like, you know, we started to smash the tiles that were covering things and there was like exposed iron. Like it was like everything that like I wrote down, it was like,
there it is.
It was here. I was like, cool. Like what is happening here?
Wow. So
but anyway, the original question was like, you know, why the relationship with Tribeca, like, you know, the first 2 years, I mean, there was also the recession thrown in there, but like, It was hard. I mean, like, and that's what I mean by Tribeca. Like, you know, it was just like, and to your point, I didn't even really think about it. You know, back then, you know, the people that were probably going to like, you know, Boulay and Nobu and Chanterelle and, you know, Mr. Chow. And these were all restaurants where everybody was getting dressed up and going out to go. And they were probably coming to check us out. And they were like,
Why?
Well, it's incongruous.
This isn't fancy. Like, what is this? You know what I mean?
Yes.
And so I think that's probably why in the beginning it was hard to like win those people over.
Yes, to break
and
them.
And it slowly kind of, you know, the neighborhood started to like come around and, you know, but it wasn't just like instant. It was.
No, but I think that was a real turning point, especially in that era. You know, I remember when I took over at the Harrison in 2008, there was heavy velvet curtains on these beautiful windows that overlooked the water. You know, we took them down. The previous chef was like, no dining at the bar ever. And I was like, dining at the bar, dining wherever you want to dine.
Different time, yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that was a really cool time to be doing what you were doing.
So when you're like looking at restaurants, you know, from this is something I'm fascinated with. I'm always looking, trying to open a new restaurant, looking at a space. There's something about that, like feeling you walk in and you experience it. When you're looking at new construction or you're looking at somewhere that you're not familiar with or doesn't have those bones, is that something that you can kind of, can you fake that? Or is that something that just either has to be there or it's.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I'm kind of the wrong. No, maybe I'm the right person to ask. Like, I don't like shiny new boxes that you get to. Not that it's just me. It's just my opinion. I don't like coming into a shiny black box and being able to like build around it. Like, there's to me. I mean, it's not a coincidence. Like, all three of my restaurants in New York. You know, even the new one that I'm moving to, is the old Danube,
yes,
or Brushstroke. Mm.
Was that the original building? No, it was his second
restaurant. It was called Danube.
Sorry, they're freaking out here because I'm like, we're like real inside baseball. We're like throwing the ball back and
forth between the three of us.
The other two restaurants that I have are Peasant, which is like, again,
this is a perfect segue.
One of the most iconic like spaces in lower Manhattan. And then I just took over the 1/5 space, which, you know, most people remember as Oto, but it's been a restaurant since 1927.
Oh my God. Oto was with the flat top pizzas.
Yep.
Genius. Yep. But thank you for making Peasant.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we need to give
alive.
You a thank you
yeah.
gift.
Yeah. That
thank
was really
you
special.
For 100%. Keeping Peasant alive.
The best part is, as I asked him, I was like, can I keep it Peasant? I don't know if you guys know Frank.
Did you put a yes. gas fire in there, or is it still?
No, are you crazy?
The first time I walked into the Peasant restaurant, he was boiling water for pasta over a wood fire.
Yep.
And I was like, what is this guy's out of his mind?
He's the best. Frank
it was
is
incredible.
Like,
and every single chef that I know has this dream of a wood-fired yes. restaurant, and
No, I got it. I got my dream. I mean, it's like... I don't know if I want to say this publicly, but like, if I could just do that.
Like, you can say that publicly.
Can you talk about,
it's
so
just
what is
to
Peasant?
Live in New York and just do that? But I mean, like, I was just there last night. I mean, it's just like.
It's clear that the universe is listening to you, but.
It's just like, I'm getting goosebumps. It's just the best. It's so hard to explain. And I don't know why every chef wants to have these fire restaurants, but there is something about like rolling your sleeves up and like, taking a piece of meat or taking a head of cabbage and like throwing it into embers and then like fishing it out and like peeling off the charcoal, cutting it in half and putting good olive oil and anchovies on it and eating it. Like,
it's because
you can't do that at another restaurant.
I love this. This is primal. This is what we all want to do. We love fire. I mean, I know I'm a pyromaniac. I know that's part of why I love cooking, is that the management of this fire that is... Yeah. So unruly and so wonderful, but Frank,
it's funny. I get to wear two hats. Like Forge is like, you know, the like, you know, take a hit off a joint. Like let's get creative and cerebral, and let's see what we can turn a cabbage into. And then Peasant is like, throw the fucking cabbage in the fire.
Yes.
So I get to live like those two lives, which is really fun for me.
You get to satisfy all those sides of the chef. And for anybody who doesn't know, Frank DiCarlo,
he's best.
Is this legend.
I think all kids, you know what I told them to do? I was like, retire and just like hang out in the kitchen, and we should just send kids to you instead of culinary school so that they can learn what a real chef is.
Genius.
We were just talking about this.
It's the best.
We were just talking about training young cooks who need direction and best. how hard that is.
You know, so the whole courting thing of me taking it over started in August. So then I kind of like hung out in and around
August.
Was
a couple
that 2020?
Years ago?
No, it was 2019, right?
19.
Yes.
August 19. It's a funny quick story. I'll do it as fast as I can. But
say what you got to say.
So I hosted a New York City Food and Wine Festival dinner there because I was signed up to do a wood burning restaurant, which fell through, thank God. but I was like, I want to showcase some fires to like kind of give press to this new restaurant that I'm going to open. And I was like, I called Frank and I was like, hey man, cause I eat there all the time. I used to live on Mulberry between Grand and Hester. I called Frank. I was like, hey, can I host a dinner at Peasant? And he's like, yeah, sure. Sounds good. I was like, okay, great.
Whatever you want to do.
So we do the dinner. And because I was hosting it, you know, I gave like the opening or closing remarks. And I just gave like a very heartfelt, real speech about Frank is the chef that every chef on TV wishes they could be, and he like he's the guy, like this is like what cooking is supposed to be, blah blah blah. Peasant is my favorite restaurant, but I wasn't bullshitting, like I was
right.
Like, so after the speech, and like for anybody that's listening, like you know always like kind of pay attention to what you're saying, where you're saying it, because you never know who's listening. But I give this speech, and after the speech, he comes over to me, and we're having a glass of wine at the bar, and like, he just looks at me very, like, serious, you know? And he's just like, did you really mean everything that you said when you were talking to everybody? And I was like, yeah. And he goes, okay. And that was it.
That was
and
it.
We finished, we drank our wine, da-da-da-da-da. He called me, like, whatever that was, that was in October, right? That's the Food and Wine Festival.
Yes.
So then he called me in August. I was at a manager meeting. I see Frank DiCarlo. I answer the phone. And he's like, you sure you meant everything you said that time when you gave that speech? I was like, yeah, why? What's up? He's like, well, I'm retiring. And I thought he was just going to ask me to like cook a dinner for like the last week or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's just basically like, so you want it? I was like, do I want what? He's like, do you want peasant? I'm talking to you. You understand what I'm saying? Like, do you want peasant? And I'm like, of course I want peasant. Like, what do you mean?
Like, who doesn't want peasant?
And he's like, well, I'm out of here. And, you know, I don't want it to turn into a bank or I think he said, you know, Apple Store. He said something like that, you know. And I want a chef that's going
to
respect.
Dwayne Reed. Yeah, I don't want it to turn into Dwayne Reed.
But he said, you know, there's a lot of, he said point blank, there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears went into this place. I want to give it to somebody that's going to, you know, do it. But again, he didn't ask me to keep it peasant. As a matter of fact, the exact opposite. Like, I asked him. I was like, do you mind, you know, if I keep it peasant? Like, it'd be my honor. Like, you know, again, you know, and he was like, do whatever the fuck you want. It's yours. But anyway, so I spent a couple months. And listen, I mean, at the time I was 40, so he must have been mid-50s, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know. I might be off by a couple of years. If I came there at 9 a.m, he was in there. He lived upstairs. He'd be in there in a pair of shorts with his dog on a leash, stirring a ragu before he was going out to walk the dog. If I came there at 7 o'clock at night, he was on the line with a bandana tied around his head, working the pasta station. I mean, if I came there at 1 a.m, he was downstairs in the office, smoking a joint, writing everybody's paychecks. I mean,
wow.
It was just like,
but you'll never
see it again. I mean, it was just
like the dream. And is he now actually retired? That's it. He made his money. He had his restaurant. He had one restaurant.
He went out east. And I think they have a restaurant. It's like weird. It's like a place. It's like an Italian charcuterie
like
place. They do dinner like twice a week. Set menu, kind of Chez Panisse, old school style.
Right.
You know, it's like 6 courses. They pick it, you know.
It's just such a dream. Like the idea of, what's enough? Can I have one place that I really love that I put my time, energy into, make enough money that I can actually eventually one day retire, and then that's like my whole story? Or, you know, I know for me that's not enough. I want to have so many different restaurants, and I want to do so many different things, and I want to be here in New York while they're making pizza in LA at the same time. And
what's tough though? That's what we're trained to do now. Mm-hmm. Like our world, not just chefs. I mean,
right.
Everybody's trained to, you know, if you keep working and open as many things as you can, you're going to have a yacht someday. You know what I mean? Like, we don't need a yacht.
No.
But we're forced to think that we need a yacht.
You know? But I almost feel like it's come full circle because, you know, baby chef Amanda always just wanted her own restaurant.
Yeah.
And that was going to be my life from start to finish. And that's where I was going to wrap it all up. And then the world became where you had to be a hospitality group and have 10 different restaurants all over the country. And now you have to do everything else and write a book and have a show and be on TV and run your restaurants, multiple concepts, and have a family and be a nice guy and sound great on a podcast. And I feel like it's going to come full circle where you're saying, I just want to be like Frank.
Oh, I'm getting there.
I want to be like Frank, and I just want to be in the kitchen every day. Like, that's going to be the end goal now, where that was the ultimate goal in the beginning.
It's funny you said that, because my, like, 10-year plan is to basically do what you just said. Like, my retirement is to have a restaurant.
Right.
And my group, hopefully, knock on wood, right, will be the group that we all hope it turns into, and then I can just
do what you really want to do.
Throw cabbage into a fire.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, it's so funny that we have to do all that just to do what we want to do.
Well, we think we do. Again, that's what has like, you know, that's what success is now.
Okay. So speaking of peasant, your sister is there.
Yeah,
is that correct?
She's the GM. She's killing it.
She always been in the industry?
No, it's a great story.
Young sister, older sister?
Younger sister. You know, she was working in fashion and she called me, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. You know, hey, I'm like, I want to get out. I don't know what I want to do. Da, 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 da.
I'm making too much money. My life is too easy.
Yeah, I'm working 9 to 5. I got time on my hands. I'm relaxed. Like, you know, it's like.
So true.
So, but I was like, I'm about to take over Peasant. Like, do you want to, you know, I don't know, come help me? You know, not knowing where it would go. It's just like, hey, sure. And I, you know, she came in and COVID happened, and she started like 2 weeks before COVID. I mean, it was like crazy. COVID happened. So then she had to be there for like the reopening of COVID. Like she didn't even get to see a real restaurant for like the first 2 years of being in the hospitality industry.
But she hung in there.
She like, I mean, to watch her do what she did in the circumstances she was in, I mean, it was just like, you can't teach. I mean, right. It was just like.
Yes, that's a natural.
Whoa. Yeah, you know, I'm like, Jesus Christ. And again, we could do a whole podcast on that year and a half.
Right.
But it was just amazing to watch. And she just kept, you know, we had a manager and she just eclipsed him. And like, you know, it just like
She grew into it naturally. That's great.
And now, I'm coming
a peasant. That's it. I hadn't thought of the name peasant in years, and I was like, when I was like, where should I go eat? And I was reading your bio, I was like, why he took over peasant? I didn't even know that. I'm so excited about that.
Yeah,
it's
listen,
amazing.
I don't mean this in like a conceited way, but I mean it to me. It's like, you know, it's like one of the best places just to come. And
it's a spectacular.
Like you can get a fancier, more expensive meal. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's the best restaurant in the city, but I mean it's like. You know,
it's what we want to eat.
Yeah, like you can't find. I don't think you can find like a better night out eating than like coming and sitting at Peasant.
I'm fascinated with this idea of like hospitality and how depending upon where you are, hospitality, the concept of it changes. Like you come to my house. And hospitality, the greatest level of hospitality I can offer is like grab your own beer, mikasa sukasa, like make yourself comfortable, sit on the couch, put up your feet. But like you pour someone's glass of wine in a fancy restaurant or their water and they expect that. And that's what hospitality is. And peasant for me and that like, I guess quintessential what I think of is like Italian hospitality is this like warmth, and the fire is like the quintessential example of that whole the hearth, and you sit around it and you really share and feel that it's a special place.
It's a special place.
I
tell people this too. There's no windows once you get in the main dining room, and like you're transported. Like you're not in New York City anymore. Like, and then when you leave, you open the door, you're back in New York City.
Yep.
But I'm telling you, once you get past the bar, it's like. I watch people because I'm using, you know, I can stand in the kitchen and see the whole dining room. You just watch people's faces. They go.
Yeah.
Like you could be anywhere.
Yeah.
That's what it's about to transport you somewhere else. Restaurants.
Yeah.
We won't talk too much about lockdown and COVID, but I do want to touch upon the fact that, you know, Peasant was barely open. And then all of a sudden you and I were pivoting, but you at least were trying to run a restaurant still. And we were cooking on
meatballs, Jesus
screen.
Christ.
We were doing what we call virtual events.
I still have PTSD every time I make a meatball. I swear to God.
What happened?
So we were hired then to, I mean, this great company called Zinc Agency. Will Steinberg, who owns it, is a friend of mine, and said to me, hey, would you try this? And we did it first on Zoom. He's like, I don't know if it'll work, but, you know, I have a lot of these corporate companies that have dollars to spend what they usually spend on, you know, team building events. Can you do it over screen? And I was like, I mean, we're in the middle of COVID. And I was like, I'll try anything. I'm locked in my apartment, right? I made gnocchi.
That's crazy.
I made gnocchi about 100 times. Mark made meatballs. And eventually this became a thing where I was doing it 3 times a week, sometimes 4 times a week, where 50 to 100 people would get on a Zoom or a virtual feed that would go to them of us teaching them how to make this thing. They had the ingredients in their home and they would cook with us. And the very first one I did, at the end of the hour, everybody turned on their camera and showed a bowl of gnocchi.
Wow.
And I was emotional because we were not connecting with people at all at that time. We were so separate from everybody. I was like, holy shit, we can do this.
It was wild.
And we did it over and over and over again. And actually, the night I came to Peasant, you had a virtual event in the basement going on with our crew from Keystone Productions. And I don't know how you did it. I don't know how you would set up. There's a lot of tech. I did all the tech at my house. The tech guys came to you, or you did it yourself.
Oh, we did it in my house too.
Yeah, and we would teach these classes, and we were entertaining. It was a way new form of hospitality.
Yeah.
The first one was on a, like, literally on my laptop.
Yes.
And then by the end of it, I had to, buy a new laptop. I had, I mean, this is what my kitchen looks like. If you look around. Like, yes. And I had a one-year-old sleeping, like, 15 feet away. Like, my wife would come out and do the dishes with me after we were done. I mean, it was wild.
I don't know. You
sometimes you do two a day.
People.
I mean, yes. It was crazy.
Yes.
But it kept the lights on. I mean, it was like...
Yes, it was a savior. It was a savior for me. I think it was a savior for the people on the other side of the screen.
I was just about to say, the people, that they were so excited to, like...
See us, talk to us, cook with us, quote unquote.
It was like a little, you know, drop of sunlight in like a cloudy time. I mean, it was like crazy.
It definitely, being stuck at home, definitely gave people more opportunity to learn how to cook than ever before, and brought more influence. And I think it also pointed out what a great gift it is, and an essential skill that has been lost in America. Like the ability to cook. Fewer people today know how to cook than ever before in history, and more people want to cook.
Right. But everything that people want to is like, how often does somebody get to be in their kitchen with you?
Yeah.
They're looking at Mark Forgione's kitchen. Like, that's cool. Like, he has everything I have, and he's a chef.
I used to say it almost every demo. Like, it's not magic.
Right.
Like, right now, we're going to take everything that's in front of you, and we're going to make it taste really good, and we're literally going to do it in less than an hour. Like, no magic tricks, no TV meatballs coming out of the oven. Like, we're going to do this. And, like, they were like, there's no way. And I'm like, here we go. And obviously, it's the same thing with you doing the gnocchi. Like, 60 minutes.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, and it was real.
It's like a fantasy. It's like being on a Zoom with Julia Child, you know, and cooking with her. Like, the things that we can do now are fascinating to me. And, you know, what you did during that time was incredible. So... Anyway, your son was one at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Your son's name is
Sonny. Santino.
Oh. Is he in the kitchen? Does he cook?
He loves cooking, yeah. He loves eating. He loves cooking. You know, the first thing he says whenever he comes to one of the restaurants is, take me to the kitchen. And
that's where he wants to go directly?
Yeah, he just loves looking at it. I mean, he loves it.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, he loves to eat. He's got a particular palate. He knows if I put too much, like, black pepper in something, he'll call me out on it.
Are you kidding me?
That is spicy. Oh. And I'm like, son of a bitch, I did try to sneak in a little pepper.
That raw, clean palate, never been touched by cigarettes or alcohol.
No, he makes...
I'm 5 years old. You know, I can smoke it. What are you talking about? I was in my pop's ashtray long before that.
But he'll make scrambled eggs, you know, he'll flip the pancakes, you know what I mean? Like, he has his little plastic knife, he likes to cut stuff, you know.
That's amazing.
And again, I'm not forcing anything.
I
want him to have that relationship. You know, you just said it, like, there's so many people, Americans, whatever, that, like, you know, don't have that, you know, if I'm hungry, I need to be able to cook.
Right.
Like, I want my kid to have that. Like, I had that, you know, and... I saw a big difference, like, when I went to college, for example. Like, it wasn't like I was a professional chef by any means. But, like, I could, like, make myself food, like, you know.
Of course.
And some of my roommates, like, couldn't even make, like, a grilled cheese. And you're like, you don't know how to make
greatest,
grilled cheese?
It's the greatest gift you can give yourself
up?
From health 100%, and popularity. And you eat better, you eat cheaper. It just opens up
the whole
world.
I was just about to say,
too.
Yeah, it's a great way to impress, you know.
Oh, my God. I would never get laid. I would never get laid if I couldn't cook. I mean. Pretty much. I mean, maybe. Moving on. Do you travel?
Moving on.
Hey, how about that travel? You want to come over later? I'm cooking.
That's sexy.
Hey.
Yeah, that's sexy. Well, okay, speaking of those college kids who didn't know how to cook, these are the people who are probably coming to your restaurants now. And at 1/5, you're doing some really edgy stuff, you know, and how do you, for edgy for maybe that palate, right? How do you get people to love uni and duck liver and veal tongue? Like, talk to me about why you even want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is not like a forcing thing. And I don't throw it in people's faces, like, at all. You know what I mean? It's more like, I hate to say sneak in, but Crostini, the Tuscan Crostini, you know what I mean? Like, everybody will eat a Tuscan crostini, you know what I mean? But if you say, you know what I mean, this is a chicken liver mousse on sourdough, they might go, ah, I'll pass. But
right.
You say Tuscan crostini, they eat it, and you tell them, hey, this is what that was. You know what I mean?
I like that, though, because one of my favorite things to do as a chef is convert people to liking things that they say they don't. They say they don't like beets, or they say they don't like oysters. Like, I love to show them, you know what? You might.
Yeah, you haven't had it.
I'm a weirdo with the tongue thing, because I personally think the tongue is like one of the most flavorful, delicious things on almost any animal. And we serve tongue at all three restaurants in some way, shape,
really?
Or form. Yeah, it's so good. I mean, it's like if you like a short rib, there's no way if I blindfolded you and gave you a piece of tongue on a fork that was just cooked with some, you know, red wine sauce the same way, like,
I love
you
it too.
You can't look at me and tell me you don't like it. Like, it's impossible.
It my pop's favorite sandwich was a corn tongue sandwich.
Oh, it's the best.
Tongue sandwich. It was like corned beef, but yeah.
Right.
You can't find it anymore. And also, tongue got expensive. That's crazy, right? It used to be free.
I told my chef to get some skirt steak in yesterday.
How much was it a pound?
Ridiculous.
Tell me. I need to know.
It's $18.50 a pound.
It's ridiculous, yeah. Everybody discovered it. It's
skirt
a nightmare.
$18.50.
Yeah.
Not Wagyu.
I mean, it used to be $3.29 a pound.
Yes.
I'm shocked because it did. It was three. I mean, hanger steak used to be $2 a pound.
Hanger. It used to be a nickel and you could get a pair of shoes with that.
I know. But where are those people now? It's so fucking crazy.
I used to walk to work with no shoes on.
But back to 1/5 real quick. So like 1/5, we just kind of like shifted. Because, you know, again, I forage and peasant were like easy. Like I knew what I was going to do. Like,
right, of course.
Easy. No problem. Forage was like my life's work, I guess you could say. Peasant, I wanted to make it my life's work.
That's
it was
your
very
soul,
easy.
Though. I feel like that's your soul.
And 1/5, you know, it has, you know, like Oto was such a beloved restaurant, right? And like, you know, a lot of like neighborhood people, because it was such a neighborhood restaurant, you know, came in and, you know, I'm sure you've dealt with this before. You take over a space that's been beloved for so long. And, you know, I think, you know, as well as I do, for reasons, obvious reasons, like I couldn't just reopen Oto.
Of course not.
You know what I mean? And I think, you know, we kind of went off a little too far from it, because I was trying to, you know, the last thing I wanted was somebody to write an article about how Chef Ford Jones just reopening Oto, you know what I mean?
And of course, blah, blah, blah. You got to break the pattern.
So now, you know, we spent this year and like, you know, I'm talking to tables, I'm doing as much as I can and da 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 da. And like, you know, we're not doing flat top pizzas by any means, but you know, now we're doing like pizza and, you know, this homemade pasta program, which we make in the dining room.
What do you mean you make in the dining room?
You finish the pasta table side?
No, we make the pasta dough in the dining room.
Oh, that's cool.
Like if you remember, again, going to Oto, they had like that charcuterie bar.
Yeah, kind of thing. I was going to say that, like a marble area.
So we turned that into like a pasta station where the guys...
Are you doing like extruder? Are you doing...
We have extruder. We have fresh dough stuffed. I mean, we have...
You're doing it all.
Everything. Yeah. And it's like really starting to hit its stride now, because now people are coming back.
That's a big restaurant. There was a lot of seats in there.
It's big. But now the comments that we're getting is kind of, and you know, I'm explaining to people the same thing I just said to you guys. Like, I was like, you have to understand, I couldn't just,
of course,
put some paint on it and, you know, call it 1/5 and, you know, serve Oto food. But now people are coming back in and saying like, you know, thank you for, you know, kind of,
right.
I'll use the term calming down a little bit, you know? I think I got so excited too by the fact that the farmer's market was right there.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Like, I went very vegetable heavy in the beginning, and people were like,
neighborhood.
You know, they were like, I want carbonara. Like,
people craved what it was. Are you thinking about?
You have to put your ego aside sometimes.
It's a tough one when you're taking over New York City iconic space like that, and you know it's right in the middle of. I mean, I don't even know. I would call it Union Square, Washington Square Park. It is a gorgeous. Gorgeous area of New York City.
It
really is iconic. And the pressure you feel when you take over a space like that is intense.
Yeah.
So you want to bring your best self. You feel like you have to make a mark. You can't literally mark.
Yeah. Hey.
No. But I love the fact that you then said, okay, and I think maybe this is maturity, right? As young chefs, we may not have been able to say this. You know what? I'm going to go back into the dining room and listen to what everybody's saying. And I want to do this now. And a combo, you know, a little bit for you, a little bit of tongue for you. No puns intended over here.
No tongues intended.
A little tongue in cheek. One to know.
And a little bit for the neighborhood. And enough so that you're not totally losing your identity, though. Yep.
And also, too, like I said, like, it's like, it's almost like my third child, you know what I mean? Like, you know, you kind of learn from the first two and like, you know, now the third one, that's like, it's okay to be you. Like, you don't have to be like the other two. And
right.
Like, I think that's, you know, One Fifth is really, like I said, starting to hit its
Do you have some like next dream goal or thought of something you haven't done yet, restaurant wise, or a place that you are inspired by? Or do you think like, oh man, my roots, I worked in these fancy French restaurant. Do you want to do French food or?
I don't think so. I think as I get older, like it's almost like, you know, simpler and like quality over quantity kind of thing. And
but what about like country style? That gets me so, I'm like, everybody thinks that French food is fancy and Italian food is rustic. I'm like, French food is like this beautiful rustic Cassoulet country cuisine. And
so when I worked with Gerard, most people don't know this, but like Michel Gerard's restaurant is on this property that has three restaurants. Everybody obviously always talks about Le Pré de Eugénie, which is the 3-star Michelin and basically created Michelin dining.
I'm a spa cuisine man myself.
So then you know. I don't know if you know.
Yeah, of course.
So Michel Gerard has the Cuisine Mansur, which is the spa. But then I swear, I don't think I've ever met anyone that didn't work for him that knows about this other restaurant, which I thought was the best one. Very peasant-esque, actually. It's called La Ferme au Grive. And, you know, not by coincidence, there were, you know, two or three suckling pigs roasting, you know, every day over the fire. You know, they served foie gras mousse in a jar, in a mason jar that they popped open at your table with bread. Ugh. You know, no matter what you ordered, you got a bowl of polenta. No matter what, you got a bowl of polenta on your table.
I like that style.
I just feel like
it was like, you know, funny thing is when I took over Peasant, I tried to serve polenta to everybody. Nobody ate it. I was like,
by the way, we the first time I tried
family meal.
I tried to serve polenta.
I would be so happy.
Like Italian polenta proper, and no one ate it. And then I put a pound of butter in there and a quarter cream in, and everybody thought it was their favorite thing in the world.
Now we sell polenta and they buy it, but like I tried to do the whole thing where like I wanted like Peasant to be known for the polenta, and like it didn't like.
I feel like the big takeaway for anybody traveling to France is like get out of Paris and go to the countryside and really like all these big cities. We all have the internet; they're all like the same. And then but the true identity when you're traveling is outside in the small towns in the country and the little restaurants that are, you know.
I just did an Italian trip, two trips actually. But the first one was to Sicily. Mm. And I don't know if you've been to Sicily, but we went to the city or town of Noto.
Uh-huh.
And before I got in the cab, I went to... because I was doing an event with the chef there, so I had like gotten a little friendly with the staff, and I went to like one of the busboys, and I was like, "I'm going to Noto. Like, where should I eat?"
Smart.
And, like, and he told me, and if you remember Noto has like a strip, you know, I don't want to say Times Square, but it's like where all
that's
the tourists
square.
And everybody's eating, and there's a whole line of restaurants, but this place was you had to walk up a hill, make a left, go up another hill, and like my wife was mad at me. She's like, "What the fuck?
Where
are you taking me?" But, you know, and, you know, you don't read about this restaurant, and I don't even remember the name of it, to be honest with you.
Of course not, yep.
But I'm telling you, it was probably the best meal I had in Sicily, and it couldn't have been less fancy.
Yeah, my best travel experiences are always like, something went wrong, the plans got, you know, whatever, and then you had to just wing it, and you ask someone, the taxi driver, the bus person at the restaurant, and that's when you get the real...
Yeah, 100%.
The real deal. Okay, so you probably... covered most of Italy, right? You've traveled there so much.
Yeah.
And that's obviously your heritage. I love to cook that. You love to cook it, Dan. But you have something, your partnership with KO, is that how you say it?
Kyo.
Kyo. Yeah. Is that something you dabble in the Asian cuisine type thing? Or is that just something you believed in and wanted to invest in?
So I do dabble. Like Forge has hints. I worked with Patricia Yeo, if you remember her.
Yes, of course
from
I do.
EZ and Pazzo.
I was going to ask you if you stay in touch.
We don't necessarily stay in touch, right. But if we see each other, we hug each other. And then I also, you know, it was like a sneaky, you know, like 8 months I spent with Kazuto Fan and his wife, Vicky. They were the ones that started Xinhua in Maine.
Oh.
The opening chefs of Xinhua in Maine.
I mean, holy cow.
Yeah, it was awesome. They had a very short-lived restaurant in Times Square called Above. Anyway, so if you add it all up, I spent like, I don't know, maybe 2 years getting like some really cool techniques from both of these chefs.
You add it all up, you're 138th Japanese.
So at Forge, you know, I call Forge like a true like American mm-hmm. restaurant for what, like, you know, real New York restaurant, if you really think about it. But anyway, one of my sous chefs and, you know, one of my best friends now, he's from Laos. And, you know, I think we were living together at one point, you know, back in the day. And like the food he would cook, I was just like, I've never tasted anything like
right.
it. To this day, I've never tasted anything like his food. It's so unique and flavorful and crunchy and spicy. Mm. And you eat it with your bare hands and like you just rip things apart. And you make lettuce wraps and like,
what
it's
was
just
it
so
that he
good.
Made you? Was it a stew type of?
Everything.
If you could pronounce it properly in Laotian languages.
But I basically told him at the time, we're going back like maybe 10 years, I don't know. You know, he was like my executive sous, corporate, whatever you want to call him. Mm-hmm. And he was just like helping me out. And, you know, he made family meal for the staff again. And I was just like, yo, Pat, like whenever you want to open a restaurant, dude, you just tell me. Like I'll do whatever I can to help you.
Right.
6 months later, he's like, I want to open a restaurant. I was like, all right, let's do this. And I try to tell everybody, I don't have any input into the food whatsoever.
Right.
It's just my friend.
So you're supporting. So that's your friend that you supported
that's
to
it.
Do?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
Yep.
And I mean, because every chef talks so much trash about how they would support everybody. But when it comes down to it, you know, it's like.
They don't actually do it.
You put my money where my mouth is?
Yeah, no. I mean, it's,
that's amazing.
Yeah. And he's a great guy. And, like, you know, it's. Again, for anybody that hasn't met the Kia, like it's just, you know, it's a fun, loving,
I wanna go.
Amazing. Wait for Laotian New Year. It's like,
okay.
It's in like March, I think. But it's just great.
Well, I think we're of a generation of chefs that always sort of gave back. And I'm sure you have an alumni of chefs that have graduated from working under you.
They're all old now.
And you're ageless. You are ageless.
You do look very young.
Thank you.
Do you have like a cream that you, is there some holy water?
But I do think that I was taught to give back because I was given too. You know, a lot of my chefs treated me like they were my mentor and I was their mentee. And then I always felt like I had to do that. I remember Diane in particular always taking me to events and introducing me to other people. And I do that now with my chefs that I take to events with me. I have no, if they want to go out in the world and be who they are, I'm going to help them, right? If they're willing to learn. And I feel like there's something about putting that back into our industry that's so beneficial. You keep putting that back. You did that for him. He's going to do that for somebody else.
Yeah. And I think there's a responsibility that we have, too, to, like, pass that down. You know, I know it's, like, not comparing, like, you know, NBA basketball players to chefs, but, like, I just heard... I don't know, I think it was Kendrick Perkins, you know, one of those guys on TV, and he's just like talking about the NBA players today, like they don't understand, you know, the passing of the torch and like how important it is to like play a full season and not sit out because you're saving yourself for the playoffs and people pay their money. Like, I think there was something about our generation that, you know, we took the torch from, you know, these guys that only had one restaurant and, you know, worked their ass off and did the thing and, you know, In our world now, it's a little, I don't know what the word is, but, you know, like, not confusing, but there's a lot of
it's
distraction.
A little disconnected,
there's a lot
I
of
think.
Yes, a lot of distraction. And I think I agree with you. It's like our responsibility to, like,
pass that on.
Try to pass it on, yeah, because it's
mentor,
it's
an example. Yeah. The behaviors that we have learned over time are the actually important, and that we're going to look back on and, you know, from our graves one day, and be proud of for ourselves, and make sure that we're giving that, and because otherwise, if we just tell everybody, you know, what you really want to be is an Instagram influencer, then they're going to look back and think, Jesus, I wish these guys would have told us how phony.
Yeah. Well, like I was just going to say, like, let them know it's okay to be the chef of a restaurant.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to be, you know what I mean, with David Chang or, you know, Mario Carbone or like, you know, like those, they're unicorns. You know what I mean? Like, that's not normal. You know what
not
mean?
Only
like,
that, but they're not necessarily happy.
Like, they might not be.
It doesn't
who knows?
Bring them, you know, like, what brings you happiness might be mastery of your craft and really feeling proud of what you're doing and connecting with your guests. Like, that experience talking about Zoom cooking class, it's like you just being able to connect directly with people and teach them to cook is so special.
And that's what I'm saying, but like, show them, like, this is, never mind, this is okay. Like, this you said it. I mean, I have written down in my marble notebook, you know, what's my goal? To have a restaurant.
I think that's it. Wasn't plural.
There was no S.
I think that should be said over and over again. Exactly what you said is that it's okay to be a chef of a restaurant. And I almost said just, but it's not just.
It's hard.
That's a big deal. Yeah. And to have longevity and keep a restaurant open and to employ people and have them work for you for 5, 6, 10 years. I mean, that's unheard of, right? But that's one of the biggest joyous accomplishments. You know, like, I find that knowing that I had somebody working for me for 5, 6, 7 years was something that I was most proud of.
Yeah.
To have a team that wants to be with you, stay with you, grow with you. I think that's huge. We are almost out of time, and you are going to win a prize, and confetti and balloons are coming down from the ceiling because you haven't said anything about your dad.
Oh, my God.
You did it.
We had a little bet going on that said, you know, we can make
it. I don't bring up my dad,
Do you know how many times I bit my tongue?
I'm surprised you guys haven't. You guys should deserve a prize.
It was our goal.
It's usually how it starts. So what was it like being Larry Fitzgerald's son?
That's why I was like, we're not going to talk about that.
We spent a whole episode and actually learned this. You accomplished so much in your life. It's like you brought so much to the world, and it feels so annoying to...
It's all good. I tell people all the time, I couldn't be more proud to be his son.
But does he get to finish the seasoning at home when, like, is he like at the final tasting?
Well, don't fuck with the Godfather.
Like, you know.
No, but my brothers cook. Yeah. You know, like you know, even Kara, like, she gets in the kitchen now. Like, when we're all cooking, it's funny. I'm going to use the word funny. Like, there's a lot of, like, you know, like, let's just say, like, Brian, he's my younger, I'm the oldest, like, you know, Brian will be making the sweet potatoes or something, you know what I mean? And, like, you know, I'll just, like, walk over and, like, you know, and I won't, like, say what it needs. I'll just give him, like, a, if you think that's good, all right.
Are you sure you're going to do it that way?
Or, like, you know, it's the same thing. Like, I'll be cutting something and I'll be like,
You know, walk away.
Like, that's how the Forge Island kitchen goes. But it always goes to the Godfather.
My wife is always, you know, I work at the computer at the counter, and she cooks sometimes. And she's just like, you're looking at me. I'm like, I'm not looking. She's like, and I am. I'm looking at her cooking, and she's just like, you gotta turn your chair around if I'm gonna cook. All right.
So your brother is the only person who is not in the industry. Is that correct?
I have one little brother. I have two brothers and a sister. Yeah. So my youngest brother, he's, I don't know if you want to call him the smart one. He, like, lives like a hippie. Like, you know, he, like, does these types of things and sells rocks and gems and
good for him.
Yeah, man. He's like, he chills and he, you know.
Was he kind of your guide into a little taste of spirituality? Was your brother the person who kind of brought you in that direction?
No. My whole family has become very spiritual. And it's going to sound crazy, but it all started with a book that somebody gifted me on, like, a 4th of July weekend, like, 12 years ago, because I didn't have a book and everybody else was reading. And, you know, this person was like, yeah, read this. Called Many Lives, Many Masters.
Of course.
And it's a book about past lives and then the people that are in your lives now. And, you know, I think I actually gave it to Lindsay now that I think about it. And then it just like kind of sparked. And then like next thing you know, we're, you know, doing sweat lodges and vision quests and a lot of spiritual work that we all still do.
Yeah.
Try to get together once a year.
You were very ahead of your time on that, especially in the chef world of chefs being self-destructive and not taking care of themselves. And now I think wellness and self-care and taking care of yourself as a chef is more prevalent than ever.
Yeah. Well, it was a wild time. It was fun.
It was fun. It wasn't going
to
last,
though. You know
what?
It's so funny. Speaking of those days, I just walked by. I had to go to Paragon Sports, so I came down.
Oh, Jesus.
Whatever street that is. 14th?
14th.
No, not 14th. 17th.
17th.
The Park Bar.
Yes.
Remember the Park Bar?
Yes.
And it was like 12 in the afternoon, but it wasn't open. I like just peeked my head in there, and I was just like,
PTSD.
I mean, sitting in those windows, I mean, talk about Jean-Louis smoking cigarettes. Like, I mean, it was just like, it was a fun time.
It was a fun time. And I just love that we can still talk about it.
Yeah.
That you're still doing
it. Made it out unscathed, right?
Made it out unscathed, and that you're passing it on and sharing it with your family and sharing it with all of us. So I can't thank you enough for being here. Honestly, I love talking to you. Thank you.
Listen, I'll do this anytime you want. Let me know.
Great. Our next guy just canceled. Stick around. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Woo!
That's fun.
Yeah. On the Line was recorded in New York City at Dubway Studios. Thanks, Al. Our studio engineer and editor is Mark Frangiolo.
Our theme song is an original composition generously donated and played by Chef John DeLucci.
Our producer is Cindy Augustine, and our co-producer and publicist is Jesse Gerstein.
That's all, folks. Thanks for listening.